Of Artificer Creation.
Welcome to episode 142 of the Let's Talk Photography podcast. I'm your host, Bart Buschatz, and this is the show for July 2025. This month's solo topic is really quite simple. I would like to dedicate you to one piece of advice. Don't try to use a phone camera as if it's a high-end DSLR. It isn't. So let that reality guide your use of this wonderful photographic tool, avoid its inherent weaknesses, and lean in to its inherent strengths. Gonna start with a little bit of backstory here. So as I record this episode in late July 2025, I am coming to the end of 2 weeks of annual leave. And one of the things I've been focusing on while I've been liberated from the day-to-day concerns of normal life is preparing for a presentation I've promised to deliver to a Mac user group later in the year. It's around about Halloween time. It's quite a while away yet, but it's a very broad topic. And so I've basically been asked, since I shoot exclusively on iPhone, to talk to the Mac user group about shooting on iPhone. I'm never sure if such a broad topic is a blessing or a curse, but either way, normally I have a lot of things I need to keep in my head and to be noodling on and thinking about, but now that I'm on annual leave, I have a little bit of empty headroom. So I've been noodling away on the right way to give that presentation, basically to get a story together. I often think of these things in terms of a narrative, right? The same is true when I'm writing show notes for even very technical sounding podcasts like Programming by Stealth. I always like to have a story to tell, a narrative, basically. And so I was like, okay, so I have this massively broad topic. I'm going to spend some time here trying to get a story into my head, and I got one. The basic structure of the talk is going to be built around the concept of this show, which is the art and craft of photography. But I'm going to reverse it. So start with the craft, the practicalities of using the iPhone as a camera and of using Apple's Photos app as your editing software to basically have a full iPhone workflow that involves just Apple's native apps. And there's various, you know, practical things I've picked up over all my years of shooting iPhones, so that's easily half a talk there. And then we'll switch gears into the art of photography. And I will definitely be starting off with some, you know, reminding people of some generic advice that I know they've heard before, because I am by no means their first photography speaker. Big picture stuff. I'm going to lean in to my view that you shouldn't be afraid of cropping. In fact, you should be the opposite of afraid. You should crop, because that's how you perfect a composition. So I definitely want to hit that point. But the main thrust I want to dedicate the second half of the presentation to is about avoiding the iPhone's inherent weaknesses and leaning in to the iPhone's inherent strengths. Because, like I say, the iPhone isn't a big digital SLR. It doesn't have a big sensor. It's a teeny tiny sensor. It also doesn't have one big lens. It has lots of little lenses working together. It's doing an awful lot of computation. It's a very different form factor. It can do things a traditional camera can't, and there are things a traditional camera can do that the iPhone isn't so great at. And so, if you avoid what it's not so good at and lean into what it is, you end up with more creative, nicer iPhone photos, or photos taken with an iPhone. But that, okay, so the talk is iPhone specific, and this show expressly is not. It's about the art and craft of photography. It is absolutely not brand focused. We don't do that here. So why am I talking about it? Well, What makes the iPhone is kind of a two-part thing. So you have the physics of small sensors, and then you have the... There's a lot of really good ideas for how to use the compute power of modern machine learning to do very clever things with the constraints provided by a phone. And a lot of them have their origins within Apple, but they didn't stay there because good ideas spread. And so actually, now that this space has matured as well as it has, when you stop and look around, the iPhone strengths are not only the iPhone strengths, they're the same strengths as similar high-end phones with good cameras from other vendors. So actually, if we take off the iPhone-specific focus, there's actually a good discussion to be had here about the art, really, in this case, of of using a camera on a phone to its best effect. And so that is today's show. So I want to start with the weaknesses and talk a little bit about, strategies for avoiding them. But I do want to dedicate most of the show to leaning into the strengths, because I think that's, or at least I'm doing that second because I want that to be what sticks. Let's start into those weaknesses then. So small sensors, by the very physics of how optics work, result in deeper depths of field. And artistically, we prefer shallower depths of field. So this is, not like what you would like to have from a full-frame sensor or whatever. The reason the full-frame sensors are so popular in the big boy cameras or big girl cameras is because they give you that nice shallow depth of field. Well, you don't get that when you have a teensy-weensy tiny little sensor. So, okay. And we have computational photography, which offers workarounds where it's using a 3D depth matrix to recreate the ability to change the depth of field in post. And when you think about what's actually going on and the physics of it all and how the smartphone vendors are achieving this, it's kind of impressive. And the computer scientist in me is extremely impressed. But those depth maps are much more coarse-grained than reality, which is distinctly analog. It's distinctly, unless you get down to the level of quantum physics, at least, it's distinctly gradual, not in steps. So those portrait modes, as they're usually branded, which give you these shallower depths of fields in software, I mean, they're not just adding a Gaussian blur. They are using various sensors to figure out which bits of the scene are at what distance and reconstructing waveforms. I mean, it's pretty darn clever what's going on with that computational photography. But it's not fine-grained. So that means it doesn't do particularly well with edges. And that goes double for edges with loops. So hair that's not perfectly straight is the perfect example, because you should be able to see the blur through a loop of hair. But an awful lot of the times the software will end the blur at the edge of the head of hair, and the holes will be in sharp focus. So you'll have tiny bits of background in sharp focus peeping through in the gaps between the hair strands at the edges of the head. And anything else that has that sort of a looped structure, where you have closed loops, you tend to get that same effect. And if you don't zoom in too much, and if the effect isn't too big, it may actually be fine. But it's something to minimize your use of. Never say never. Everything I'm saying today is about minimizing and maximizing, not about thou shalt never and thou must always. So don't necessarily assume you can't make use of portrait mode. Sometimes it's amazing. Sometimes it gets it really deep. Sometimes it's a fantastic job, but I don't think you should rely on it. And I think you're probably better off assuming it won't work and having some other thoughts and ideas in your head about how to do the composition. And the single most important thing that means is you should be thinking about your background more, because you can't assume you can throw it out of focus. So that means you need to be much more careful about picking your points of view, picking your zoom levels, so as to have the distractions not there. Therefore, you can get away without them being as well blurred. And, you know, especially if you use a 2x or, well, if you use a 5x zoom on the cameras that have it, you really do get a lot of background blur due to the zoom. But you may pay for that in other ways, like we'll get to in a moment. So, you know, work around it as best you can. But I would say aim not to rely on the blur. And if the focus mode or if the portrait mode kicks in and if it works well, hey, great bonus. But I wouldn't bank on it. I certainly don't. I see it as, I'm glad that worked. Not as something I'm going to rely on. Yeah. Like I say, avoid, not never. So as I've hinted at there, small sensors have another problem, is that if you have a small overall sensor, you will have smaller individual pixels. Smaller individual pixels need to be activated by fewer photons, which means the signal-to-noise ratio is worse. Just the laws of physics here. So that means that what's coming into the signal processing chips is of a lower quality than what the DSLR gets to work with. So those little signal processing chips have way more work to do. They're also on a way more powerful device. They have amazing machine learning capabilities these days. So they have a better chance of doing it than a digital SLR, which is why most of the time we kind of forget how inherently noisy those tiny sensors are. And for most of the time, it doesn't get in our way. We can take amazing shots in surprisingly low light on our phones. But under the hood, it's a bit like a duck on a pond. Under the hood, those phones are frantically pedaling to suppress that noise, suppress that noise, suppress that noise. And the things that make the noise worse and that make the phone have more work to do are: the less light you have, the more difficult it is, because that signal to noise is a problem, right? The ratio is the ratio. But if there's less signal, well, then there's more, you know, it's basically low light means they have to work really hard and you can end up with strange. Usually it doesn't come in the form of noise getting back in. Usually it comes in the form of artifacting, where you pinch to zoom and suddenly you have these weird, unnatural textures that makes it look like someone has, I don't know, it's a really weird effect when it happens. So be careful of situations where there's more noise than the system handles gracefully and your image degrades to being all artifacty. And like I say, the trigger for that is too little light, and you get too little light when there is simply not a lot of light. And remember that the act of zooming, what you're actually doing is you're taking the same light cone from reality and you're spreading it out more broadly across the sensor, which means that as you stretch something out, it gets thinner. Or if you spread out a light cone, each individual point at the end of that cone gets fewer photons, i.e. more noise. This is why in astronomical land, the more you zoom in, the bigger a telescope you need, because everything gets fainter by the act of zooming it. You're stretching it. And so if you have lots and lots of light, you can get away with using those amazing 5x lenses, and you can get away with at least a 2x, no problem. But as the light reduces, it is wise to steer clear of the 5x and maybe the 2x. And actually, you can kind of have the opposite effect. You can concentrate the light by using the wide-angle lens. And so as your light reduces, how much you zoom should reduce too. But again, no hard and fast rules here. It's bear it in mind, lean into it, but don't, you know, if the only way to get the shot is to have a go at a higher zoom, even though you're a little worried the conditions aren't great, well, have a go. What's the worst thing that can happen? It doesn't come out when you bin it, right? No different to what would happen if you've never had a go. So, you know, hey, have a go. But bear in mind that you're better off finding compositions, finding ways of capturing the scene that involve less zooming, the less light there is. And that particularly, again, I can only speak with first-hand experience here from the 5Xs on the iPhones. It happens very quickly that there isn't quite enough light. Again, you're zooming five times. The next physical lens I have on my camera is a 2X. So the difference in 2 and 5 is huge. So it probably shouldn't come as a surprise to me that that 5X is very, very sensitive, at least twice as sensitive to noise as the 2X. And again, simple math here, simple laws of physics here. So bear in mind, zoom less the less light you have. The other thing that these little cameras have is they tend to have, on the one hand, more technologically sophisticated autofocus sensors, perhaps. And yet, on the other hand, they're a little bit too AI-driven and stuff, and they tend to get confused, is my experience. Not always, and they're getting better. And if you remember that you can use your finger to tap on specific things you'd like to get in focus, you have a better chance. But there are situations where that autofocus just doesn't cut it for me, and I just can't get the sharp shot I want. And in particular, I noticed this because of what I shoot. I notice this the most with very, very small things that poke up. So if you have something with small detail that's relatively flat, as you get really right in close, the autofocus will lock on perfectly because the whole scene is at approximately the same distance. The camera will kick into macro mode and it will maximize its depth of field and you'll get great focus and it'll be amazing. But if the thing is pointy-uppy, if the detail, the bit you want to be in focus, is sticking up towards the lens, I find the smartphones have a devil of a time trying to realize that when you're tapping your big stubby finger, what you mean is please focus that little tiny thing that's probably falling through the cracks in your autofocus system, which may not be fine-grained enough to even notice the darn thing. And sometimes you wiggle the camera about a bit and you get persistent and you kind of get there. But, you know, it works. But what really makes it not work is if the see from the tiny is breezing, the tiny little thing you're trying to convince the phone to focus on is wiggling about at all. Good night and good luck. You're just going to have to find a different way of capturing that subject. Maybe instead of shooting it top down so that it's poking straight up, but you start to go at a more oblique angle so that it has more of a chance to lock onto something. You're just going to have to find a different composition because that autofocus isn't great or isn't perfect. And the other thing is sometimes stuff is just moving too quickly, right? There's a breeze and the flurry you want is fluttering about, or there's an insect that isn't quite sitting still, or there's something big in the physical world that's moving quickly. You just mightn't get it. And at the end of the day, if the image isn't sharp, it's not going to work really, is it? Well, sorry, parts of the image not being sharp can be amazing, but if the subject isn't sharp, that's usually a problem. Almost always. I'm sure you can find an edge case, but basically, it's a throw the shot in the bin. So you got to bear in mind, there are things the autofocus just isn't going to do. Another thing you just have to bear in mind, and you can compensate for it a little bit, is that the physics of smartphone cameras is that they use rolling shutters. That means that due to the physics of how sensors work, unless you have some sort of a physical shutter, like you have with the digital SLR, which can allow all the light in at once, let it be captured by the sensor, close the shutter so that you now have no more light hitting, and then the camera can read each row one by one by one by one, because that's how it works. You read a row, you read the next row, you need the next row. So you're scanning down through what the sensor has collected. If you have a physical mechanism for blocking the light that happens very quickly, then the fact that the pixel values are read out in rows doesn't make a blind bit of difference, because the light was captured effectively instantaneously. The shutter released so quick you can't really tell, and it closed so quick you can't really tell. So it really is a snapshot with over the exposure time. But when you have an electronic shutter, well, there is no physical device moving up and down, right? A DSLR clicks because there's a thing flapping up and down. There is no thing flapping up and down in your phone camera. There's just no room for such things. Well, that means that the exposure isn't being controlled by a physical block. So there's no way to stop the light hitting the pixels. So what you're doing is you're reading them sequentially while there's still light arriving. And so what that really means is that your exposure, it's the same length of exposure on every pixel, but it's not happening at exactly the same time in the top row of your image and the bottom row of your image. So the top row needs to start exposing, then the second row starts, then the third row starts, then the fourth row starts, all the way down to the bottom, and then they get read back in that same order so that you have each pixel having the same amount of milliseconds of light hitting it. But now we have a rolling shutter, which means that anything that's moving across your image, so perpendicular to your sensor field is where it gets the worst, it's going to have a slant put on it by the fact that it's moving. So if you have something like, say, a side-on train moving from right to left across your field of view, the top of the train's cab will have been exposed a little bit before the bottom. So the bottom will have time to move further. And the effect is sequential, so what you end up with is a sloping cab. Even on trains that don't have sloping cabs. And the faster the thing is moving across the sensor, the worse the effect is. The lower the light, the worse the effect is, because the exposure is a little bit longer. And so if you can't handle the distortion, you're just going to have to change the shot so that you don't have something moving crossways across your field of view too quickly. Because there's nothing you can do to make the rolling shutter not be a rolling shutter. And so one thing you can do is, well, don't shoot it face on. Change your angle to the thing so that you're looking at it at an oblique angle instead of edge on. Or zoom out a bit so that the actual number of pixels being crossed in the exposure time is reduced. Again, that would give a double effect, because by zooming out you get more light, so the exposure time can shorten. And because you're zoomed out, the same physical meter of real world planet Earth is now fewer pixels, so you get a double whammy there, and zooming out helps you twice, and the rolling shutter effect will probably vanish away very, very quickly. Now, the thing is, you need a bit of experience here, because you, generally speaking, can't make it happen again. Hey, steam train, any chance you could back up and come back to me? Right? Not really going to happen. So this one takes a bit of practice, but it's something to bear in mind. If the distortion doesn't work for you, if you find it distracting, well, you're going to have to avoid it by being aware that you have a rolling shutter. With all of those, beware lessons out of the way, let's look at the other side of the ledger here. Yes, your camera phone is a compromised device compared to a dedicated hardware camera. But it does give you advantages over a dedicated hardware camera, the most obvious of which is simply that the phone is the camera you have with you, pretty much always in the modern world. So serendipity is so on your side when you shoot with a phone. So I dedicated an entire episode to the concept of luck, just 2 shows ago, LTP 140. And a big factor in how often you get serendipitous shots is how often you are in the world with your eyes open, watching for things with a camera, able to capture whatever bit of serendipity comes your way. So having the phone at all times gets you half the way there. The other part you still can't avoid is you need to keep your eyes peeled. You need to be on the lookout for photographic opportunities. You need to be open to serendipity. Otherwise, you can have a camera with you as often as you like, and as many serendipitous things can happen around you as you can't believe. But if you're not noticing them, they're still wasted. But you have a much better chance with the phone than with a dedicated piece of hardware, because the dedicated piece of hardware isn't with you all the time, but the phone probably is. So that straight away is an advantage. It's the phone you have with you. The other thing is, these phones at this stage, because we're so used to using them as cameras, and I presume because a lot of the designers working for Apple and Google and Samsung and all these companies have kids, and kids are notoriously unpredictable and can be extremely cute at short notice. They all have quick launch mechanisms for the camera. They all have different ways where you can get shooting really bloody quickly. And I've seen it in keynotes where one of the features that gets highlighted is how quick the camera app is to start, and how easy it is to trigger the camera app, and how little it takes to start taking pictures. Well, again, that's like the camera you have with you on steroids, right? Take the time to discover and configure your particular phone's mechanisms for quick launching that camera. Get good at it. Practice it. Right? Be able to do it without thinking. Have it be a reflex. Just have that phone whipped out with the camera running and ready to shoot in 1 or 2 seconds. You can do it. It's just practice. So put in the practice. Now, the always with you is in some ways down to the fact that it's nice and small and compact. And okay, great, nice and small and compact means it's easy to keep with you, but it also means it's very easy compared with a bigger, chunkier camera of getting into unusual points of view. Especially because nowadays we tend to have dedicated hardware buttons, or if not dedicated in the strictest sense of the word, as in this button does nothing else but be a shutter, you have physical hardware buttons which, when the phone is in camera mode, act as the shutter. So in Apple universe, that means the volume buttons. So you can hold the thing over your head, you can hold it upside down because they have gyroscopes and they'll self-right themselves, and use the volume button at the bottom of the phone to trigger a shot while you have the camera way, way held up high. Or while you're hunkered down and have it between your feet. In fact, the lenses are so close to the edge of the screen, or the edge of the device, the bezel of the device, you can get those lenses to millimeters above ground level. You can get points of view that are physically impossible without a shovel on a bigger camera, because you'd have to get the body into the ground. Whereas with your phone, with its lenses right on the edge, you can get these amazing low fields of view, or low points of view. I absolutely adore hunkering down. I literally hold the phone upside down so the lens is right at the bottom, rest it on the ground, and then tilt it up slightly to get the flower or whatever into focus, and it will loom into the shot and you'll have a soft focus sky behind you to just the nature of how close you've gotten. And then use the volume button to fire. You're not lying belly first on the ground, you just hunker down a little with the phone down between your hunkers and use the volume button to fire, and you have the thing in a perfect position. It works really, really well that way. I do that a lot and I find it very rewarding. And, you know, kids and stuff, you don't have to get all the way down to the ground, just get to the eye level. Dogs, cats, kids. Terrible to put those in the one sentence, but the same logic applies. You want to have them not looking, don't look down on them and don't have them looking up, but you get down to their level, look at the world from their point of view, and you will have more compelling photographs. And that's just way easier with these small light cameras than with a big chunky traditional camera. These phone cameras have worked around the fact that they can't have a big stonking lens because depth is at a premium. And one of the ways they've worked around that is by replacing this notion of one lens to one sensor to one photo and having these multi-sensor arrays which do all sorts of clever tricks, like a single exposure, even through a single lens on the iPhone, for example, will often actually involve the shutter firing multiple times and the digital signal processing chips stacking those images together and creating a much better exposure by taking multiple exposures and combining them, because it gets that signal to noise for you. It does so without blowing out the highlights or the shadows. And so you can end up with these very impressive dynamic ranges, which I think we take for granted now because our phones are so good at them. But if you're shooting on a traditional digital camera and there's even a small amount of shadow because you're living in Ireland and in the winter the sun just doesn't get above 30 degrees in the sky, those shadows, they look fine to you, the human being, but to a traditional camera, they go black. They lose all their detail. Not to a phone. The phone handles those dynamic ranges amazingly. And not just, you know, the dynamic range is caused by low shadows in the winter, but also way more extreme dynamic ranges. Like, you can point an iPhone at the sun. You can have, the old rule was you wanted to feel the sun on your shoulder or you get a terrible exposure. Not with an iPhone. You can have the sun in the shot if you want. It'll give you a nice little sunburst and you'll have lots and lots of detail. It won't blow the whole exposure out. When you stop and think about it compared to the way we used to have to shoot, it's amazing how freeing this much higher dynamic range is. So don't worry about shadows. You can use them as a feature in your composition. They're not going to cause you trouble. You're still going to have detail in them. And shoot straight into the sun. You can have these amazing backlit effects and stuff, and the camera will handle it shockingly gracefully. So that is an amazing advantage of the very clever electronics, which were not a great compensation for having not the deepest depth of field, but they're an amazing feature, an amazing strength when it, you know, they're also the cause of the rolling shutter, but again, amazing strength when it comes to dynamic range. So lean into the dynamic range, avoid the rolling shutter. Lean into the dynamic range, avoid the simulated depth of field. And similarly, those multi-sensor arrays, as when you go into macro mode, that array really is acting as an array. And that allows the camera, between stacking different exposures and using all the different lenses, it allows the camera to capture way more depth of field than one teensy-weensy tiny lens and a teensy-weensy tiny sensor could ever capture on its own. And so you can also enable things like focus stacking, where as well as taking multiple exposures to get the, you know, dynamic range right, you can also take different exposures focused in a little bit behind, a little bit in front of, a little bit on the subject, and combine that information together in the signal processing chips. And so between exposure stacking, focus stacking, multi-sensor arrays, you end up with so much detail being captured in macro mode. So much more from so much closer than you would normally get. And that is very powerful. Again, there's a caveat here that if there's something poking up a little bit too much, and if it's all jiggling about a bit too much, the autofocus mightn't be, you just mightn't get a lock on the bit you want. But you know something, when that doesn't happen, it's amazing. So do not be afraid to shove that camera right in shockingly close and get really fun textures and details and stuff. It will blow your mind what it can do. And then the final killer feature that's enabled by this whole multi-sensor exposure stacking approach is amazing night modes. Right, so what it's actually doing is it's actually taking long sequences of video and then image processing them to stabilize them in post and then start stacking those pixels. It's a technique that came out of astrophotography. You would use webcams to image planets and stuff, and basically, as the stuff inevitably jiggled around in your field of view, well, the jiggle is not that big, pixel to, you know, frame to frame to frame to frame, so a little bit of machine learning can easily realign those frames and then stack them to get these amazingly deep exposures. And that's what's happening in real time. It's more and more information is being continuously fed into the same image using machine learning neural networks to keep everything aligned. So then as the phone jiggles and as everything else, you know, naturally jiggles, it doesn't go out of focus. Instead, the right pixels go in the right place and it stacks up and you get these absolutely unbelievably well exposed images and like shockingly close to absolute darkness. That, you know, it's amazing what they can do. They're limited to the fact that if there's too much stuff moving around too quickly, it ain't going to work. And if you're, you know, it can only compensate for so much of your hand movement. So again, zooming less makes everything easier because there's more pixels and there's less jiggling. But very simple things can maximize the effect, like finding something to lean on and bracing your phone with your elbow spread nice and wide into a nice solid triangle. When you see photographs that I share of aurorae and stuff, that's how I get them. I brace myself on my elbows, becoming a natural tripod on a fence or a wall, something, anything that's that an appropriate height that I can brace my elbows on. And that is enough to get that exposure time right up, which is enough to pull the detail and the low light right out of the image. It's amazing. And of course, you can take it to the next level with a little portable tripod. Like, you can get little tiny little pocket-sized foldy-uppy things that, you know, are no bigger than your phone when they're folded up. And they, you know, you fold the legs out, you twist it around, and you telescope it up, and you clip on the phone. And hey, at that stage, you're getting into half-second or half-minute exposures. And you can get, like, the Milky Way and stuff. And all of this from something so small you have it with you all the time. In the winter when the stars start to put on a nice show, I don't just keep my phone in my pocket. I keep a tiny little foldable tripod in my pocket. It's I think it's from Gobi, actually, the little one I have. And the whole thing folds up to be smaller than the iPhone itself. And so basically it takes a second or two to, you know, fold its legs out, twist it up, clip the phone into it. But once you have that done, you can take 30-second exposures in night mode and it will absolutely astonish you what can be picked up. So lean into those night modes, lean into those macro modes, lean into the fact that you have this amazing depth of field. Make the most of the fact that you have a device you can easily move around into different points of view, and always, always, always keep your eyes open, keep your eyes peeled. There are opportunities everywhere. So, you know, lean in to the advantages you get from shooting with a phone instead of a traditional camera. Don't try to blindly force the thing to behave like a DSLR. Don't keep shooting like as if you had a DSLR that just wasn't very good, because then the photographs you get just won't be very good. Avoid the things that the DSLR can do that the phone can't, and lean into the things that the phone can do that the DSLR can't, and you will be rewarded with way nicer photographs. I am going to draw a line under it there. Thanks to the joys of hay fever, my voice isn't great because as soon as I lie down, my whole head clogs up and I spend the night mouth breathing, and then my throat gets all sore and then I can't talk for very long. You didn't need to know that, but hey, I'm in an oversharing sort of mood, I guess. Either way, my voice isn't holding up to anymore. I hope you found that simple topic interesting nonetheless. I hope I've inspired you to rethink how you get the most out of your phone. You will have noticed that you are now at the end of the show and I'm blathering away and there have been no ads. And this isn't an accident. This is because this show is 100% listener supported. You folks help me to pay the bills every month. That's all I want. I am not a podcaster to make a living. I make a perfectly good living as a cybersecurity specialist. I really enjoy that work. But I don't want the podcasting I do for fun to be a cost center in my life. So what I want from the podcast is that they break even, that my bills each month get covered. It's not 100% true, but it's approximately true and has been approximately true for a few years now. And, you know, all of you who have helped make that so in the past are continuing to help to make that so now. Thank you, thank you, thank you. One simple way to make it easier for the show to support itself is to make the show more widely known. If 1% of people support the show, then if that's 1% of more people, it will be more support. So if you're not in a position to support the show financially, and there are many perfect, like, on the list of things you should be worrying about when money is in short supply, this podcast should be very, 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 very far down the bottom of the list. And that means that another way you can help, if money is just not something you want to or can contribute, well, just spread the word. Tell your friends in, like, real life, that's cool. Post about it on social media, send the link around. It all helps. It is all appreciated. So anyone who has ever, does, or will ever support the shows in any way, thank you. It is such a privilege to be able to podcast without the headache of sponsorships and advertisers and all of that faffing about. I really do appreciate it. You will find, usually I say an essay version of these thoughts. That's not quite fair this time. It's a little bit more bullet pointy than essay shaped. You know, it's come from a PowerPoint presentation after all. But you will find a little bit more detail at letstalk.ie, where you will find the buttons to support the show on Patreon with an ongoing contribution or PayPal for a one-off contribution. I've been your host, Bart Bouchard. So you can find me personally at bartb.ie. And until next time, happy snapping.